Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Well, I'm very excited. We have with us a great guest tonight, don't we?
Yeah, we're gonna bring him right out, and we will observe that this is a very special day that you had mentioned right before the show started. Tell us what's special about today.
Well, Carl Sagan's birthday is today, and though Carl's no longer with us, we like to mention that. When the date rolls around every year, he's an inspiration to the show, ongoing inspiration, and. So it's always good to mention it when it rolls around. How old would he have been this year, Phil?
I was going to ask you the same thing. I wonder how old Carl Sagan would have been. He wasn't that old when he died, but it's been a while now. So I think we should have had our research department look that one up for us. But anyway, he absolutely a landmark figure in. I think kind of popularizing science, making science accessible to people, getting people excited about science, and getting people thinking about some of the kinds of issues that we talk about on this program. So our hats are off to Mr. Sagan. You are missed, sir, and happy birthday. All right, well let's bring out our guest. This is someone that we've had on the program before, but never live before. This is Ramez Nam. He is a computer scientist based in Seattle, Washington. He's the author of More Than Human, Embracing the Promise of Biological Enhancement, for which he was awarded the 2005 H.G. Wells Award for Contributions to Transhumanism. Ramez led teams working on early versions of Microsoft Outlook, Microsoft Internet Explorer, and most recently the Bing search engine, where he served as overall director of program management for 1 year and led program management for the ranking and relevance team for 5 years. Between stints at Microsoft, he founded and ran Apex Nanotechnologies, a company working on advanced software tools for molecular design. And he's currently at work on a book about the near future, a science fiction novel centered around advances in neurotechnology, and a nonfiction book on overcoming peak oil, climate change, and other resource and environmental challenges that face us. His blog is entitled Unbridled Speculation. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Ramez, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Phil. Thanks, Stephen. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great having you on live. We were talking before the show started about how we had you on for a short segment once last year and meant to have you on for a full show, and now we finally got you. So,
fantastic!
It's a big day. It's Carl Sagan's birthday, and we finally got you on live. So,
doubly big day.
Things are really falling into place. Well, we do a lot of different kinds of show on Fast Forward Radio. We do shows built around a particular topic or like a theme, and then sometimes we do what we call sort of a future grab bag, and that's what we've got tonight. We've got multiple topics that may or may not have any particular relation to each other. They were just things that struck our interest and that we decided to grab. But Ramez, let's start first with your topic, with the topic that got me in touch with you and that brought you to the program tonight, and that has to do with Moore's Law and solar power. You put a piece up on the Scientific American blog site about the relationship between Moore's Law and solar. So step us through that. Is it really fair to talk about what's happening with solar energy in the same kind of terms that we talk about Moore's Law, this kind of exponential growth curve?
Well, Moore's Law is definitely an analogy here. It's not the exact same thing that's happening. It's not more transistors on silicon, but it's something analogous, which is that, you know, when people talk about Moore's Law in computers, usually what they actually mean is just that computers get cheaper per unit of computation each year, and that's happening exponentially. And the same thing is happening in solar energy. It's not happening as rapidly. Moore's Law in computing, price performance goes up about 40% per year that passes. In solar, it's about 7 or 8% price performance improvement each year, which means that every decade you get a little bit about around doubling of the watts of energy that you get per dollar investment that you put into solar. And if that trend continues, which looks likely, then in the next 5 to 10 years, solar photovoltaic cells are going to be cheaper for electricity than existing coal power plants or natural gas power plants. So that's very good news.
Well, it's hugely exciting. I mean, this is what Ray Kurzweil refers to as the solar singularity, right? When you cross that, I think you described in your piece a 12-cent mark, right? If it's 12
cents
per volt or less, then you're paying less for solar power than you would for power that's generated by coal or by oil or by some other fossil fuel.
That's right, and that's the national average. So in some places like California, coal electricity is more expensive and solar is more abundant. So they'll actually probably cross that line in the next 5 years ahead of the rest of the country.
Hawaii may have already crossed the line. Their energy is almost all from diesel generators, I understand, in Hawaii, and of course they have plenty of sun. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting because in Hawaii they have to ship all that diesel in, I assume, right? Obviously,
yeah,
they're not
right.
Pumping any diesel there.
It has to get expensive, I would assume. Plus,
yeah.
I mean, you think about all the pollution now. I mean, they've got plenty of winds blowing it out to sea, and they're so it may not be just sitting right on top of them all the time, but. You can imagine, think if Denver, Phil, had to generate its power by diesel.
Right.
It'd be pretty bad.
It would be extremely expensive, yeah. So the fact that Hawaii is in a nice nexus there, right? They get a lot of sunshine, which means that they can take advantage of solar power better than places that don't get as much sun, and they're paying too much for energy to begin with, right? So they cross the line sooner than others will. So here's the big question, Ramez. Do we have good reason to believe that this trend will continue and that we'll hit this that we'll hit this 12 cent point or whatever the point is?
It looks pretty likely, and I'd say there's two big things that make that look pretty attractive right now. Maybe three. So I'll start with the third one first, which is why does Moore's Law exist in computing? Well, it exists because it's possible to etch lines smaller on silicon. But it also exists because that expectation is set. Intel and AMD and other chip makers know that they have to reach that line of Moore's Law in order to compete with the chips their competitors are going to have on the market. So now we have dozens of solar photovoltaic companies out there using different approaches, traditional silicon cells, thin films, organic semiconductors, all sorts of things. And they're all looking at this line, and they see that to be competitive a few years from now, they have to meet it. So they're all using this as kind of their internal targeting. Secondly, when you look at their internal roadmaps for production costs and even the roadmaps put together at large workshops, for instance, NREL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, operated by the Department of Energy, put together a workshop last year talking about roadmaps for the next 10 years of solar manufacturing costs. And they found that without any huge technological breakthroughs, you could get down to that 50 cents a watt manufacturing cost that would correspond to about 12 cents a kilowatt hour or less electrical cost. And then the third is this trend is now 57 years old. The first solar photovoltaic was introduced in 1954 at a cost of about $1,000 per watt. At the end of this year, the cost per watt is now about $1.20 per watt. So you've had almost 1,000 times reduction of price in 57 years. So this is not trends and going on just a few years.
we don't really know if it's going to continue. If that 57-year-old trend continues over 10 years, then we'll hit that mark, and that's very good news.
That's really exciting. I mean, what's the world look like then? What happens? Do we do we stop mining coal? Do we shut down the refineries?
It'll be a gradual switchover. I mean, when you have coal more expensive than solar more inexpensive than coal or natural gas, it's still a huge investment to replace all of the existing power generation utilities that you have right now. So that'll take decades, most likely. But what you do see right now is, and here I'm going to broaden the conversation to wind and other energy sources, that most of the energy, the new capacity being brought online in the U.S. is already renewable. In 2004, only 2% of the new electrical capacity brought online was renewables, wind, solar, hydro. In 2009, that was 55%, so more than half. We don't have the numbers for 2010 or 2011 yet, but it's conceivable that it's now three-quarters of the energy, the new capacity being brought online in the U.S. is wind, solar, and hydro, and mostly that's wind and solar. And by 2015, that could be virtually 100%. So first, they'll take over all of the new capacity, and then as you have coal plants kind of reach the end of their lifetimes, they're not going to be replaced by new coal plants. They're going to be replaced by new wind installations and increasingly new solar installations.
Interesting. And I wonder how that will pan out. Will there be big solar farms? Will everyone have panels on their roofs? Will it be a combination of those two things? What do you see happening there?
It'll definitely be a combination. I mean, a lot of solar people like to talk about the advantage of decentralized energy, and that advantage does exist. Rooftops are a place you can put solar and collect energy. But it also, it varies by location to location. You get better efficiencies of scale by large installations. So even though you have to transmit the power, if you build a large installation out in the desert, that cost of transmission, the distribution lines and so on, is more than offset by the lower installation cost of building a large centralized facility there. And then most Americans consume more electricity than can be accounted for by their rooftops. But there's a large amount of untapped land in the U.S. and in the world. Using current solar PV efficiencies, 13-14%, you could provide enough electricity to power all of humanity's energy needs through 2030 using about 0.5% of all of the Earth's land area. And that's itself about 2% of all the world's deserts. So you have a huge energy source. The sun is a source of about 6,000 times as much energy just to the Earth than all human civilization uses. And we have enough unused land that by building large solar installations out in the desert, we can capture more than enough of that to power us. And then we'll supplement that with rooftop solar and other things like that deployed inside of cities.
That's
cool.
Yeah,
it's really cool. In the chat room, Jab says that the Japanese are planning on putting solar on all new buildings by 2030, but they're also now talking about putting solar on every building, old and new. So apparently in Japan, they're getting on top of this. Looks like a really interesting and exciting set of developments here. And you know, when you talk about these solar farms that might take up potentially 2% of the world's desert surface area, there's also the possibility ultimately of collecting solar power in space, right?
There certainly is. I'm more of a pessimist on space solar right now just because launch costs are so high. You use so much energy getting something into space. But one of the next topics in the discussion today could help address
that. What a transition. It's perfect. I told you, you are our guest host here tonight. You've set us up so perfectly. So let's talk about this this interesting development around airships offering gateways to space. This was a piece I linked on the show notes, and really interesting developments here. This was from Discovery News talking about putting a permanent lighter-than-air space station up at about 140,000 feet. It would not be in orbit. It would be in a fixed position. And the scenario here is that is that from that platform, you've got this enormous V-shaped ship, lighter than air, four times the length of an oil supertanker, that will rise up to 200,000 feet. And from there, you're going to use solar electric propulsion, speaking of solar, to slowly work that sucker's way up to orbit. Now, if an infrastructure such as this were to be put in place, then I think you've got a really cool way of getting stuff into orbit that we didn't have before. You would be able to support all kinds of things that are problematic, Ramez, for the reason you just said, which is that it's really expensive to put stuff into orbit, so that makes it hard to get something going like solar collection up there. It also, all talk of putting a big, space settlements, and most of the things we want to do in space are hindered by the fact that we're trying to get out of this gravity well, and we're trying to push against this big atmosphere, and there's just this major investment required every time you put something into orbit. Well, here you've got a model that kind of cheats that a little bit. What do you guys think of this?
Well, I think it's interesting and promising. I mean, someone a long time ago made an analogy for me that I thought was very vivid in terms of the cost of getting to space. So imagine you have a soda can, a can of Coca-Cola. The total weight of the spaceship and all of its cargo is analogous to the can, and the weight of all of its fuel is analogous to the contents.
Wow, there
so
you go.
Well over 99% of the energy of getting into space is lifting the fuel that
right.
you use in later stages. So if that can be reduced, and this looks very promising, then you can potentially drop launch costs by quite a lot, by a factor of 10 or more. I haven't seen cost estimates from these folks, but I think that would be very interesting to drill into what they think the economics look like.
You know what else is interesting about this is the fact that this, it would be kind of a slow boat to outer space, wouldn't it? I mean, it'd take a while to do it. But, I could imagine someone's grandmother taking this ride. I mean, this is, the original, Mercury astronauts, they were basically Olympic athletes. They picked, really brilliant people, but they also had to be in tremendous physical shape. And since then, they've relaxed on that quite a bit for the astronauts. But, still,
it's still a very physically grueling thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's extremely physically grueling, but this would not necessarily be grueling, would it?
No, this could be the love boat, right? I mean, this could be the cruise ship out into space. I mean, forget somebody's grandma. I'm not anybody's grandma, and this is the way I would go. I'll tell you that much. Given a choice, I'll take the lighter than air approach. Well, Stephen, now you were kind of a pioneer on this subject. We were talking before the show about a piece you wrote about this a while back. Remind us about that.
Well, I mean, Phil, you and I've been writing for the Speculus for quite a while. 2004, actually, I think the Speculus was launched in 2003. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So
this was early days. Yes.
Yeah. Thereafter, and wrote a little fictional account of this astronaut showing up at Dark Sky Station at 200,000 feet. I made a bunch of scientific errors that the commenters to the to this little story were happy to point out for me. I love that about the Speculus.
Yeah,
smart reader.
Great,
yeah.
Yes.
For one thing, I was talking about lower gravity, and they said, well, this guy sat there with figured out that, well, at 200,000 feet, you have like a 1% less, your gravity is like 1% less.
Yeah, technically it would be lower,
level.
But you'd never know. Yeah, exactly.
You'd never feel
yeah.
it. And, all these other things. But still, it was something that's captured our imagination quite a while back. And it was the same group that was thinking about it back in 2004. But it was very, at that time, it was, basically, just a complete dream to them at that time, but it seems like they've made quite a bit of progress since then.
Yeah, they seem to be talking in much less speculative, more kind of planning terms. I mean, now that we've got Virgin Galactic, we've got SpaceX, there's serious talk about developing space, and I think the fact that there are multiple models of how you get in there, it just makes it all the more interesting and makes it all the more exciting. One of the things that's really interesting about this model is that you know, there's a thing about airships is that they're cool, right? I mean, people have always kind of wanted there to be big dirigibles doing something interesting, and they haven't been good for much, frankly, throughout.
Yeah, I want to take this ride to Dark Sky Station from the top of the Empire State Building. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I want to get on.
Yeah. Yeah, they put the gangplank out and you walk up and yeah, from the top of a skyscraper and then you go straight up into space. Exactly right. I mean, you know, something about lighter than aircraft captures the imagination, and people have liked the idea, but it's never been commercially worth much. I mean, the Germans tried to do it back in the 30s and they had a couple of disasters and that was the end of that. You know, they're good for taking photographs, and they're good for basically photographing football games, right? You get a nice aerial shot of a football game from the blimp overhead. But this is actually maybe, you know, now that the technology is getting advanced enough, this is the opportunity for airships really to shine, for them to prove their worth. Because Ramez, as you were describing, this is the this is the technology that really makes it affordable to not have that Coke can analogy in play, right? I mean, if you've got a lighter than aircraft, you're not expending any much fuel at all, just rising to that level. And once you're at that level, you're able to launch a craft without all the friction of the atmosphere. And in fact, one of the scenarios they're talking about here is itself a lighter than aircraft that goes into orbit, and that's kind of hard to get your head around because it's hard to picture a blimp going that fast. You think about a blimp in the atmosphere, and you know you could never push a balloon that fast. But if you go up to 200,000 feet, you're not in the atmosphere anymore. And so the idea here is that using solar energy, using electrical energy, they can propel this thing slowly and slowly wind it around. It's gonna be moving a little bit farther out and going a little bit faster as it goes and goes and goes until finally it reaches that required velocity, and you've got a craft that's in orbit, and you're able to deliver payloads up. And you know what it occurs to me, and I'll run this idea past both of you guys. I'll start with you, Ramez. It occurs to me that this might be a viable alternative to or stepping stone towards one of our other favorite ideas, which is the space elevator. What do you think? Do you think maybe lighter than aircraft might move us in that direction?
And this sounds much more viable than a space elevator to me. I mean, I've seen various estimates for the cost of a space elevator, but the reality is that no one knows how to build one. So you can't actually put a cost number on it. And if you would, you'd find that it's likely trillions of dollars at this point. This sounds much more plausible. And I think for most space cargoes, which are not humans, that multi-day trip is no problem. If you're launching a satellite, it's just not a big deal if you've been building it for years to wait for an additional week or 2 weeks to get to its destination. The other trend that I think is interesting that multiplies this is that space cargoes are getting smaller. So we see now the advent of, you know, 1 kilogram, 10-kilogram satellites, microsatellites, that are able to do a lot of what old generation 100-kilogram satellites could do. You're not going to get a Hubble Space Telescope that way, but for communications applications, for environmental monitoring, for a variety of things people actually put satellites up for, you can now do it with very, very small payloads. So the combination of shrinking Earth-to-orbit costs, which really have not shrunk at all in the last few decades, this would be a great example of what they did, multiplied by the shrinking size of the payload, should make a lot of applications a lot more affordable.
Yeah, I think so. Go ahead, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, in answer to your question, Phil, is it a stepping stone? I'm going to just go out on a limb here and say that if we ever do see a space elevator, and I think it's a pretty big if for the reasons that Ramaz gave us. You know, I think it's just be astronomically expensive. But if we ever see it, I'm just going to say, It won't be to sea level. It will be to a dark sky station. You avoid so many problems with not having to go down into the atmosphere and all, you know, storms, the wear and tear, just the wind on something like that. You know, you could avoid it by having it go down to that level.
So an elevator not to orbit, but just to a fixed point up above.
No, it would be an elevator to orbit, but that would originate not from the ground or from, you know, a platform out at sea.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. Now I'm following you. So from orbit down to lighter than air, which would also then have to be in orbit, right? Because it's going to have to keep tracking with the space elevator, but it's going to be going at a much slower speed.
You'd need something in geosynchronous orbit to anchor this thing right above. Right above the Dark Sky Station, so you know that's what you'd have. So,
Stephen, you are
exactly
making me
right.
Dizzy with this idea. Okay, I'm sorry.
I think that's exactly right. People have talked about skyhooks, a lot of elevators that do solve a lot of the problems. The other thing I'd say is, these folks are talking about launch, to LEO, but if you have a stationary lighter than air platform that you can put up at 200,000 feet up, you have something that can operate a lot like a geosynchronous satellite. So it may just be that another application of this technology is not launching things to low Earth orbit, which is much, much higher than this actually, but just doing some of the things that geosynchronous satellites do already and doing them in a way that's substantially lower cost. For instance, instead of you have satellite phones now. Satellite phones are extremely expensive. Their signals actually have to get up to LEO or geosynch. I think most of them use a constellation of LEO. But instead of having that, you could use one of these as almost sort of a mobile cell phone platform, if you will, or a poor man's satellite coverage for an entire region. I can't calculate off the top of my head what the line of sight is from 200,000 feet up, but it's probably hundreds of miles. So you could potentially have kind of lower cost versions of today's sat phones, for instance, or the equivalent of kind of satellite internet, if you will, or other applications and communication hosted off of a platform like this that hovers over your city or over your region.
Yeah, it's the low cost way of sticking something up there, right? I mean, geostationary orbit is this beautiful, elegant, cosmic way of doing it, but this is another perfectly good way of doing it. And to your point, you just put something up there a little bit lower. But what the heck? Sometimes that'll work fine. Maybe you end up with a dozen of them where you would have had two or three, but it's that much less expensive to put them up and to maintain them. And if something goes wrong, it's a lot easier to put another one up than try to replace one. So there's just major advantages all the way around. Okay, well, go ahead.
I was also just going to add, and we also need to do this for no other reason than we need, like the roguish curator of one of these stations to hit on, a woman that's coming to the station saying, "You belong with us among the clouds." We got to have that.
Yeah, you do need that.
For no other reason, we need it for that reason.
We need the Lando Calrissian moment, for sure. Absolutely. In fact, Stephen, I want you to deliver that line to someone for sure. Okay.
Okay.
So we're moving quickly on. We lined up so many topics for this evening. Okay. My next one is a piece called "Out of Our Brains," and it's a real simple question. I linked this piece on the Wall Street Journal, and it's by Andy Clark. He gets deeply into the philosophy of this, but ultimately it comes down to a very simple question: are we conducting cognitive activity outside of our brains? Can we count activity that's going on not in our brains but outside of our brains as part of our own cognitive activity? And he gives some really interesting examples, sort of building the case for why, yes, maybe that is the way we should look at this. He talks about the fact that it's not just our brains but our entire bodies that we use to think. And he gives the example that spontaneous gestures increase when we're actively thinking a problem through, so that we're actually sometimes using the movement of our limbs, we're sometimes using the movement of our facial expressions. Somehow these are all factoring into our own cognitive functioning. And then you go on to the next stage, which is, well, what about what I'm doing inside my smartphone, or what about what I'm doing inside my laptop or my desktop computer, or what's happening in the cloud because of the activity that I'm, that I'm performing on my keyboard or on my keypad or via my voice. And the analogy he gives is to prosthetic limbs, which serve as add-on body parts. And the suggestion is that we're actually using now computer technology as kind of prosthetic brain, that we've actually extended our own cognitive activity out to this much broader substrate. Stephen, I already know your answer to this, so I'm going to start with Ramez on this one. What do you think? Is that a valid idea?
Well, I think Andy Clark has hit the nail on the head. When you sent that link, before I even knew who it was, I thought it might be Andy Clark, because he's brilliant on this topic. He has a 2003 book called Natural Born Cyborgs, where he argues that being tool-using primates means that our sense of self is very, very flexible. And he gives examples of plenty of studies, for instance, to show that when you're driving a car, you think of the car in a certain sense as part of your body, and you react that way. And I think it's equally true of cognitive prosthetics, and it extends to mundane things. When you are kind of brainstorming and you're jotting notes down on a piece of paper, for instance, or you jot down your shopping list, that's a cognitive prosthetic. And so I don't see any reason to think that cell phones or laptops, anything like that, is anything different.
What do you think, Stephen?
Absolutely. I've been saying for years that Google is another lobe in my brain.
Right.
I would add that Facebook is an important part of my social life. You know, I mean, it's the tools that we use now are extremely important to our sense of self. It's not just stuff. It's not just tools that we use to get stuff done. It's we're existing in ways. We are living in ways that are just simply, you know, different with these machines than we would have had. You know, than we could possibly do without them. So, yeah. I think I find it very interesting, the idea that you know, because we were tool using primates, that the transition to using computers and to thinking outside of our own bodies was easier for us. I think that's interesting. That's an idea I'd not run across before.
Well, I had this experience years ago. I used to commute a fairly long distance to work, and so I was driving quite a bit every day. And I started thinking about this relationship between my body and the car. And there really was this feeling of, you know, this is an extension of myself, or I'm sensing input from the car. You know what I mean? It's like there's something funky on the road. I'm not just feeling that with my hands. I'm feeling that with my back, or I'm feeling it in my legs, or I'm feeling it with the car itself. You know, somehow the general vibration is finding its way to me, that it's almost like you get behind the wheel and you put on this exoskeleton, this additional layer of yourself that you're using to transport yourself from one place to another, and you really begin to interact with the environment through that piece of machinery. I think that was that was quite a few years ago, but it was kind of the first inkling that I ever had that we might be sort of extending ourselves outside of ourselves via our own technology. And certainly everything that we've seen over the past few years just pushes us farther and farther in that direction. So how far does that go, Ramez? What do you think? Does the fact that we're on Blackberries and iPhones and, you know, we do podcasts and we're just kind of increasingly jacked in, does that set us up for a future in which we're truly jacked in, where we actually move ourselves over into that substrate, or does it stop well short of that, do you think?
Well, I don't think there's anything philosophically wrong with the idea that we will migrate to that substrate at some point. I think this is a long ways from that result. So, you know, I think Andy Clark would say this is a natural part of who we are as both social creatures and as tool-using creatures. So we've always had a very flexible body image that allowed us to incorporate other capabilities. And to a certain extent, we've always had a very flexible cognitive image where, for instance, there's interesting studies recently on elderly couples that show that couples that have been together for some time have the ability to more efficiently remember things
by knowing that their spouse knows something. So you kind of estimate the cognitive abilities of someone that you're with in your tribe, say, part of your hunter-gatherer pack, and you know what they know and you know how to employ their skills. So we've always had kind of fuzzy boundaries around where we start and where we stop. From there to uploading, it's still a very, very long path, but I think that's fully viable.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I wonder how that came to be that we are fuzzy about that. Is it because we're a pack animal? Is it because we live that we've always lived in groups that we were sharing cognitive functions from the start? Do you suppose?
Well, it's a big evolutionary advantage, and I think it is a prerequisite that we are a tribal species, and I think other tribal species, if we looked for it, would show some of the same capabilities. But we're also much better at communicating abstractions and using them than any other species. And so kind of anthropologists think that a critical leap in our development was when we gained the ability to communicate abstract concepts back and forth sometime in the last 100,000 years. And that led to more sophisticated tools. Before that, every tool was kind of one piece only. Then around 70,000 years ago, you have multi-piece tools, a stone for the axe head, some twine or gut used to attach that to a stick to make an axe, and you have a replication of the same pattern. All the rest of the members of your tribe have the exact same pattern there. So that combination of kind of abstract reasoning, built-in tool manipulation, and this tribal existence, I think, sets us up very well for being very flexible in how we think and what sort of physical tools and cognitive tools we employ.
Yeah, it's really interesting when we start thinking about this stuff. I think about the new Siri interface on the iPhone and the ultimate development of the.
Does that give you guys chills to watch those commercials as much as me? I mean, there's something just absolutely, it blows my mind. I mean, we're living in the future when we have something we can hold in our hands and have a. A natural language discussion with, and they give us information. To me, it's just a huge leap forward. If it works as well as advertised, I guess that's
when,
a big deal.
When the kid says, "Is it going to snow?" and the iPhone says, "Sure looks like snow to me." Yeah, that's how it works, or is that just good marketing on their part? I don't know, but. At that point, you start to go, well, that's a machine you could really sort of have a relationship with, right? At that point, when you start interacting at that level, and that's actually where I was going with that, Stephen, because you think about the couple who are kind of sharing information between them, and this idea that I know how much she knows, and I know that she knows something, and she knows that I know something, so we kind of count on each other for that. You think about how deeply entrenched we might become with our devices when we're interacting with them conversationally, the way we do with each other. Now, the potential red flag there is, does it then become a crutch? Do we not have to know anything then because we can, just like these days you don't have to know anything because you can always Google it, right? Well, in the age of Siri, post-Siri, in the age of the conversational user interface, you don't have to know anything, right? You can always just ask your phone. Is there any danger of that? What do you guys think?
I just don't worry about that too much. I think people have been bemoaning the loss of kind of rote memory and so on for thousands of years. Since literacy, it was said, destroyed human cognitive abilities. I think one of the Greeks decried this, that the oral tradition of telling stories, telling these epic poems, really trained the memory. And being able to simply write it down and read it again was a cheat. Calculators destroyed the minds of the youth of America, but I just don't think it's true. I think learning how to learn, learning how to critically analyze things, learning what to look for, what to trust and believe, how to contrast ideas are all more important than a rote memory.
I agree completely. Which is different from saying that I'm not. It's somewhat concerned that our machines at some point could overshadow us. I'm not at all concerned that something like a device like Siri, makes us dumb because we don't have to know anything. I see it more as a way to know more, think about it this way, Phil. You know, when you and I were, you know, back in, you know, high school or something, if there was something we were interested in knowing, finding that out was kind of a major deal, wasn't it? I mean, you had to go to the library, you had to spend some time
to find it or find somebody who knew how to find it, or they'd have to call somebody who could find it, depending on how obscure it was, right? I mean, yeah,
exactly.
I'm sitting there
at a restaurant with my kids, and they ask some obscure question like kids do, and I don't have to, you know, fake it or, you know.
You don't have to do what our dads did, make stuff up.
Yeah, right? just make stuff up. Or on the other hand, just like, you know, you sure ask stupid questions, you know, because you don't know.
Right.
You don't have to beat down their curiosity in that way. You pull out your iPhone, and in a few minutes, you're both learning something. So, if anything, it's just the exact opposite of that. I think it's something that will make us smarter.
Oh, I agree. To me, that's one of those devil's advocate questions that you have to ask. But I think there is another side to that, which there really is I won't say it's a caution, but it's a reality that we'll have to deal with, which is that if you reach that level of embeddedness with it, you think about, Ramesh, we were talking about the couple who depend on each other for knowledge. Unfortunately, sometimes one of them is gone after a while, right? And then the other one's left alone, and they've only got half the knowledge, right? Or if you use the prosthetic limb analogy, if this truly becomes part of your body, if for whatever reason, for any period of time, you're without it, you're in pretty bad shape, right? I mean, suddenly you're dependent on it. Stephen, to your point, it's like suddenly you've had an extra lobe of your brain removed, right? The idea is that not to suggest there's anything wrong with achieving, you know, maybe a next level of cognitive function, which is ultimately what we're working towards via embedded technology. But once you've achieved that, that technology is going to have to be there, and if it's gone, you're not going to be able to function nearly as well. Does that seem like a risk at all, Ramesh?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's introducing a level of dependence, and if that technology is gone, as you say, then we're kind of out of luck. But nevertheless, I think overall it's a more positive bet than negative.
Yeah, I think so too. It won't stop me. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
Well, let me just throw this out there, guys. You know, back a few years ago with some of my first cell phones and things, it wasn't all that unusual for me just in the course of the day or whatever just to allow my cell phone to run out of juice, right? I mean, I might forget to plug it in at night or whatever, and the following, you know, this on the second day, about halfway through the day, you know, it's gone. I don't have the battery life on my iPhone doesn't last any longer than that, but I don't believe that I have ever let this thing run out of juice. And the reason is, it's just so much more important to me.
Right.
What I'm able to do with this device is so much than just the cell phone of a few years ago, that I simply do not allow myself to let it run out of energy. So maybe I guess as these things become more important to us, we build in redundancy so we don't lose them as easily.
Okay. Maybe. We depend on our cars. When they break down, it does inconvenience us, but nevertheless, it's kind of an overall, it's a gain in terms of convenience and capability in our lives to have cars.
Right. And what have cars become over the decades is they've become hugely more reliable than they used to be. And the infrastructure to support them is much better than it used to be too. So, ultimately, Stephen, this device that we think of as this external device maybe becomes, down the road a couple of generations, it becomes a chip, right? And maybe it's sitting in your brain and it's attached to you in some way and actually running off your own body, so you could never run out of power because you're powering it yourself, right? At that point, you really would have an extension to your own body, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Or maybe solar powered. I don't know.
Well, there solar would be good too. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so that leaves us with we're down to our last 10 minutes or so, and we've got several more topics. I think we're not going to have time for erasing signs of human aging in cells. That one's going to take too much time. Let's talk real quickly about experiencing the world as an elf or a giant. This one this one really got my attention, and it kind of relates to our discussion about exporting our cognitive experiences out to another device. Here, this was a piece. This was over in Scientific American, and the piece was entitled "The Neuroscience of Barbie" by Travis Riddle, and he talks about having this experience of what it would feel like to be miniaturized or to be made gigantic. What they do is, this is a really interesting experiment. They use a brain trick to make it happen. So you're lying in bed, and they've got this video monitor head display attached to you, and you're actually lying next to a bed that has like a little doll or a great big giant body lying on it. And so, and the cameras are pointing at that. So when you look down at what should be your body on the video display, you're seeing either the little doll body or you're seeing the giant body. And there's a well-established trick. I had never heard about this before in psychological circles, to make a person feel that an external body is actually their body. They do this trick where they're touching your actual physical hand, which is out of sight, at the same time that they're touching the fake hand that you're seeing, and your body, your mind apparently will connect those two, and suddenly you feel that you're feeling what's occurring inside the external artificial body. So it's really interesting. The piece says that the people in the smaller bodies felt as though they were in this world that was populated by, you know, huge giant hands and pencils the size of trees, and that people in the giant bodies felt that, like, those same objects, everyday objects, were suddenly super tiny, like toy-sized versions of the real thing. So to some extent, actually getting the experience of what it would feel like to become gigantic or to become to become miniaturized. And I think when I read about this, it occurs to me that this is kind of a step in the direction of virtual reality. When, you know, true virtual reality, when you're able to have inside your brain an experience of a completely different body. I mean, it's not completely different. It's still, you know, human-shaped and all that kind of stuff. But you're experiencing something completely outside of your own former experience, just via the visual information that you're taking in and just via the physical sensations that you're having. That's a pretty remarkable step, and it seems to me that, Stephen, this relates to a discussion we had a couple weeks ago, that there might be some significant shortcuts to providing true full immersion virtual reality, and I wonder if maybe this kind of experiment doesn't point us in that sort of direction.
Well, I think, we talking about the car earlier, the very fact that we can feel like the car is part of our body, and we feel the bumps in the road as if, you know, the tires are part of us and things like that. Yeah, I think that there are some shortcuts that can be taken, that we don't have to wait until we're jacking in like Neo. We can experience photo worlds before them using these sorts of shortcuts. Yeah, I think it's, and quite frankly, I wish I were one of those test subjects. That would have been a neat experience.
I would really like to try that too. I was reading and I was going, man, I'd really like to experience. I don't know why, but especially being small like that. That just sounds really cool, doesn't it? I don't know if that's just a maybe I read the Atom comic too many times when I was a kid or something like that.
Well, you know, it might not be too many years until you can buy a home video game set that'll give you that experience. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, what do you think? What do you think, Ramez? Does this push us in the direction of full immersion VR?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I think that it definitely does relate to the Andy Clark topic that our bodies are very flexible. And honestly, when thinking about VR, I'd never thought about changing my own body image. I'd always thought about kind of the world I'm exploring. But that in some ways might be kind of a more powerful experience for people.
Yeah, well, especially when you start talking about relative size, because that's one of the things that we do experience throughout our lives, but it happens very gradually. And once in a while, you get this little reminder of how big of a change occurred when you revisit some places as an adult that you only saw as a child, and suddenly it's this very small place, and you have this disorienting sense of your own size. But one of the interesting possibilities of virtual reality is this idea that we can experience something completely outside of our typical day-to-day experience, and certainly suddenly being a tenth of our actual size, or 10 times our actual size, would definitely be that. I'm looking forward to the whatever that is, Wii version 11. Let me try that out. I think that'll be a lot of fun. All right. Finally, our last topic tonight. We worked through the entire list. Save that one that we'll put off for another week. A great piece on the Harvard Business Review blog network by Scott Barry Kaufman, called "Why Inspiration Matters," and this is very interesting to me. This is kind of Inspiration Day for me, because I did my other podcast earlier today, the Transparency Revolution podcast today, and I had Dr. Brent Iverson on the show. He's the head of the Chemistry and Biochemistry Department at the University of Texas in Austin, and he'd written a really good piece about the function of higher education. And we talk about higher education existing in order for us to get an education, obviously, for us to get degrees. Those things are taken as a given. But he talked about the role of the institution of higher education to inspire people, that inspiration is an important part of the overall educational experience. So I was glad to run across this piece, too. It just seemed to kind of fall into the theme for the day. And this is talking about inspiration from a psychological standpoint. So Kaufman cites a good deal of research, and he goes into a rather lengthy discussion about what's actually occurring to inside us mentally when we are inspired, what's really going on inside our brains. But it boils down to, inspiration is this, he describes it as, a surprising interaction between your current knowledge and the information you receive from the world. And, it occurs to me that futurists, people who like to think about the kinds of topics that that the three of us like to think about, that like to write about these things and think about these things, talk about these things, we're kind of inspiration junkies, aren't we? We love to have a surprising interaction between our current knowledge and the information that the world is showing us. That is, to me, the greatest experience in the world, and it's something that I seek out each day.
Absolutely, it's one of the reasons, Phil, that doing this show never gets old. We not only in the preparation for doing this show, but just the interaction between you and I and with guests. I never fail to learn something while doing these shows every time we do it. So. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's always fun to make those connections, like we've done tonight. Two topics that I thought were not related suddenly were, and then two others were kind of related, and you get this kind of I love it when that happens. It says that inspired people share certain characteristics, and those would be openness to experience, self-esteem, and optimism. And then he starts talking about the I don't know what you call it, side effects or symptoms of inspiration. It says, inspiration is the springboard for creativity. It facilitates progress towards goals, and it increases well-being. So I wonder, have we been getting it wrong educationally? Getting back to the topic that I talked about on my earlier show, are we testing for the wrong things when we put the SAT in place to see how much knowledge kids have gained, how much information they're able to spit back? Should we actually be testing at some point students to see how inspired they have become or how inspirable they are in order to really gauge how effective they're going to be?
Well, I wonder if maybe we should be testing teachers for how much they inspire kids. I think
there you go.
A lot of students check out of school and just view it as a check mark or a set of hurdles to jump through because they're not inspired, they're not excited, they don't see how it relates to them. And I think if there was kind of more of a sense of, hey, this is important, hey, this excites me,
hey, I can see how this would make my life better, it would make the world around me better, you might see people being more passionate about their schooling.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that over on my other blog, we talk about this notion of engagement all the time. Looking at HR issues, we talk about employee engagement, but it really comes down to this, I think, kind of deeper issue. I mean, engagement is one way of putting it, but you know, are people being inspired? Are they actually being touched internally? Are they being moved to do something? And if we had an educational infrastructure in place that had that as its goal, which was what made that discussion I had earlier so, you know, pardon the expression, inspiring to me, was to hear a teacher talking about how important he felt that was to be, you know, to be providing that for students, to be putting an environment in place where students could be inspired. I think that, you know, that should be the highest goal of education, and it seems like all of our organizations are educational institutions, but also our businesses and our government agencies, everything that is addressing solving problems should have that as kind of their part of their charter, part of what they're trying to do.
Makes good sense to me.
Stephen, you on board?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on it, Phil. I don't know if I have anything to add to that, though.
Okay, well, that makes three of us. And what do you know? We made it through all three, five topics, and we still have time for some music here at the end. Well, before we jump to that, I just want to say, Ramez, what a pleasure having you on the program. We look forward to having you back in the very near future.
It was absolutely a pleasure for me. Thanks so much, and can't wait to talk to you guys again.
All right. Excellent. Thank you. Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
Well, we have, hopefully, that will play immediately and not be any delay like last week. Apologize for that last week. I had a little bit of a technical issue, but hopefully we've worked it out. The music tonight is American Dream Man by Leslie Hunt. And if you stick around, I'll go ahead and play last week's music right after that so you can get a double dose of music tonight. So,
okay,
that's the deal.
We got last week's music, and I'm sorry, it was American Dreamin' by Leslie Hunt.
Yeah, or American Dream Man by Leslie
Dream
Hunt.
Dream Man, okay. All right, well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks to Ramez, and thanks to all of you for listening in this evening, particularly those of you in the chat room. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week with a brand new show, and until then, live to see it.
We're talking grand over front and it's on the top plane. Wide enough to lean on. And upstairs you've got it going on.
Now Making Me Nervous by Brad Sucks.
Taking your time.